We are in Genesis 21. It's good to be back with you, by the way, and it's good to be with God's people. We left off with Abraham and his encounter with Abimelech. It's the second time that he went and deceived someone regarding the status of his wife, Sarah, but God showed his great blessing upon Abraham in that God still was faithful to Abraham, even when Abraham was unfaithful. At the end of Genesis chapter 20, Abraham prays. Abimelech and his household are healed. God blessed him immensely. It was another sign of the covenant blessing of God upon Abraham. Clearly, when you walk your way through the book of Genesis, you recognize that the blessing of Abraham was not because Abraham was such a great guy, although he does do many great things. It's because he served a great God. Well, now we move into Genesis 21, and we come to the birth of Isaac, And as we've noted all the way along, we're just kind of giving a broad overview, tools that you can use to study this book on your own. In the account of the birth of Isaac, Moses here uses some significant words to emphasize God's promise towards Abraham and Sarah. We see that it is God who said in verse 1, God promised in verses 1 and 2, and God commanded in verse 4. So said, promised, commanded. Said, promised, commanded. The emphasis here, once again, is upon what God has done. Remember that as we've looked through the book of Genesis, we have been reminding ourselves that God is the hero of the story. God is the hero of the story. And no doubt there are lesser heroes of faith, but ultimately God is the hero of the story. And this promised son, they've been waiting for quite a few years for this son to come, and God has delivered. The name Isaac means he laughs. He laughs. That's what his name literally means. And I think this is probably not just me. I mean, most Bible commentators believe this was both a reminder of God's miraculous power and also Abraham and Sarah's previous doubts of the promises of God. You remember that when the three beings, the angels, come to meet Abraham right before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, they promise that about this time next year you're going to have a son. You remember what Sarah did? She laughed. She laughed in her heart. And the angel of the Lord calls her out on that, says, no, but you did laugh. Remember, she denied it and all of that. And so the naming of Isaac in this way would be a reminder both of God's joy in doing what he pleases, when he pleases, and how he pleases, but also their previous doubts. And so it's a great picture. It's a great name. Interestingly enough, largely from here on out, what we see is Abraham showing great faith. It's just like kind of an accelerating move upward. And I think that there is some significance to this, that he has really fully rested in the promises of God. We see his maturing faith throughout the rest of his life. That comes about even in the very next section when we get into Genesis 21, verses 8 through 21. And here we have the account of Ishmael and Hagar, with both of them being sent away. Just in general, of course, this account is fairly straightforward. As Isaac is growing up, he's a young boy. Ishmael, who was about 10 years his senior, was picking on him, making fun of him, causing trouble for him. And Sarah, the now jealous mother, is very upset about this and wants something done about it. And she wants Hagar and Ishmael cast away, and God calms Abraham's troubled heart by saying, in essence, yeah, you should send him away. And this was a very difficult thing for Abraham. We have to remember that, properly speaking, Ishmael was his firstborn son. It's a big deal to send him away. I'm sure that Abraham loved him. There's no indication that he did not. In fact, maybe, because we started a little bit late, when we get to the death of Abraham, it is Isaac and Ishmael who together are standing outside of Abraham's tomb honoring their father. I think that indicates that Abraham did have a good relationship with Ishmael. This was a very, very difficult thing. But Abraham exercises faith towards God. By removing Ishmael from the family, Isaac is now clearly seen as the heir of Abraham and the one to whom the covenant blessings would be given. This ensures God's promise of Isaac being the promised son. And as I say here, and already we're alluding to this, this is a new test for Abraham's faith. God promises Abraham, if you read through the text, God promises very clearly that he would take care of Ishmael. Abraham believed God, and God, in fact, did care for Ishmael, as we'll see later in the text. God fulfilled his promise. But also, we also see this, the blessing of Abraham is seen in God's care for Ishmael. That is to say, that promise that in Abraham all the families of the earth would be blessed, that's actually, in some sense, seen and experienced in a small way through Ishmael. We'll also see this with Abraham, and he is going to have additional sons after Sarah dies, and they are going to be blessed greatly as well. So God's favor upon him is extending out in broad ways. Now, the Apostle Paul uses this passage famously in the New Testament in Galatians 4, verses 21 through 31, to demonstrate the superiority of God's faithfulness to his promises over human effort to achieve God's promises. Thankfully, this is not a New Testament course. This is an Old Testament course, so we're not going to explore what in the world Paul means when he calls Abraham and Sarah, pictures, types. What does that all mean? And someday we'll teach through Galatians again, and we can answer some of those questions. But Paul does use this text to demonstrate the key there is that God is faithful to his promises, and human abilities and human efforts will not work to actually achieve the promises of God. Ultimately, God is the one who will do what he says he will do. So you can compare that on your own time. So Hagar and Ishmael are sent away. The significance, again, of that is the promised son, Isaac, whom God has said, this is going to be the guy and whom all of these covenant promises will be fulfilled through. That son is now the sole heir of Abraham as Ishmael is sent away. Then we come to the end of Genesis 21, and we return back to Abimelech. Now, I know it's been a few weeks, but remember that Abimelech is the guy that Abraham has lied to again in deceiving him about the status of Sarah, his wife. And so you have kind of this bookend idea in chapter 21. We begin with Abimelech. We end with Abimelech. And Abraham makes a covenant of peace with Abimelech. This is significant because it shows Abraham's first claim to the promised land. So notice this in chapter 21 and verse 22. And when I say claim, I mean actually possession of property. Chapter 21, beginning of verse 22, and it came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. Now therefore swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me, with my offspring, or with my posterity, but that according to the kindness that I have done to you, you will do to me and the land in which you have dwelt. That's interesting, by the way. You just wonder how much of this is actually genuine faith in Abimelech and Phicol here. There's a lot of interesting things to think about, that they actually seem to trust in Abraham's God. So Abraham says, I will swear. So they're going to make a covenant. This is covenant language. Then Abraham rebuked Abimelech because of a well of water which Abimelech's servants had seized. And Abimelech said, I do not know who's done this thing. You did not tell me, nor had I heard of it today. So verse 27, Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to him. Abimelech and the two of them make a covenant. And Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. Then Abimelech asked Abraham, what is the meaning of these seven ewe lambs which you have set by themselves? And he said, you will take these seven ewe lambs from my hand that they may be my witness that I have dug this well. Therefore he called the name of the place Beersheba because the two of them swore an oath there. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. So Abimelech rose with Phicol, the commander of his army. They returned to the land of the Philistines. Abraham plants a tree there. He calls on the name of the everlasting God. Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines many days. Now, the significance of this is actually Abraham for the first time, albeit a small piece, acquiring property in the land of Canaan. It was his. All right, this well is mine. Now, that wasn't very big, but it was his. So this episode shows Abraham's first claim to the promised land. And now the reason I read this account is if you read through Genesis, this is one that people tend to like kind of skip over quickly. They don't see necessarily the significance of it. But Moses demonstrates the importance of this with the use of the number seven. If you actually read through this, the names of Abraham and Abimelech appear seven times. Abraham gives Abimelech seven ewe lambs. The Hebrew word for swore an oath contains seven letters, and even the name Beersheba can either mean well of the seven or well of the oath. Now, for our Western American English eyes, unless you looked at a commentary or you have really, really studied this text, including its original languages, how many people ever caught that one before reading through this, right? That's not your natural thing, okay? And it wouldn't be mine either. Right, but for a Hebrew mind, they would see that as very significant. For the Hebrew mind, the number seven was a number of completion, of wholeness. Perfection might be too strong of a word, but it's significant in their mind. And Moses, in constructing the narrative this way, is demonstrating something big happened here. This is the first time Abraham owned a piece of property in the promised land. It's kind of like a little foretaste of what will come, right? So it's also interesting that Abraham rebukes the Philistine here. I mean, you can think about the effects that would have for later readers as the Philistines would be assaulting the people of Israel. So this was a sign of hope for the people. And again, we may not see that immediately, but the Hebrew mind would have grasped that very well. So again, the reference to the Philistines, verse 34, would remind the people of Israel that God had given them the land as they crossed over into the promised land. Yes?
Do you know the significance of him planting a turmeric, tamarisk tree in Beersheba?
Yeah, there's a lot of literature written about that. I'm hearkening back here to 4 weeks ago when I'm hearkening back to 4 weeks ago when I was re-studying through this text. It strikes me as that there is some speculation that this shows up later in Chronicles, but I would need to look back on further notes on that. But it's not altogether clear. It could be, there's some debates on that. It could be literally just, sometimes we even today will plant shrubs or trees as a memorial for something, but that also could have significance later on.
Apparently, Moses because right in the same phrase there, it says, and called there on the name of the Lord. So there must have been, there's some kind of tie there of a memorial. He planted his tree, now it's kind of like his land now, kind of like staking his claim.
Absolutely, there is at least that.
Yeah, that,
I'm just saying. I think, and I have to look back. There might be more stuff that could possibly tie into that later. I will try to remember to look that up. So, and if I don't, remind me. Just don't embarrass me in class and remind me. Remind me outside of class, and I'll. Not that this was embarrassing. I meant like don't bring it up every week until I do it. Yeah, talk to me afterwards so I can write it down. So, all right. That didn't come out the way I wanted it to come out. So. At all. Sorry, Gary.
That's okay. That's still here. That's where grace comes in.
All right, Abraham and Isaac, chapter 22, all the way down to the end of chapter 24, we have the continuation of God's promise. We come in chapter 22, the first part of this chapter, to the sacrifice of Isaac. This is one of the more significant texts in Genesis. The Jewish people latched onto this heavily as a testimony of Abraham's faith. Just a couple of things as you read through this account. You probably know it, right, that Abraham is instructed by God to go to Mount Moriah and to offer his son Isaac as a burnt offering. You know, there's the account of them going with several servants. They get up to essentially the base of the mountain, and Abraham says to his servants, "You guys stay here, I'll take the lad with me, take the boy with me." And they go up, and as they're going up, of course, right before they go up, Abraham assures the servants that you will see Isaac again, we're coming back. And Isaac asks that powerful question, you know, "Here's the wood, where is the lamb? You know, where's the sacrifice? Where's the one who, what is the being that we're going to sacrifice?" It's a powerful story. I might be reading too much between the lines. I suspect that the servants knew that something was going on, you know, which is why Abraham had to reassure them. Isaac clearly suspects that something is significant going on. And it's a jarring text. There's no doubt about it. It's a jarring text. So as we think about the sacrifice of Isaac, we need to start by identifying the fact that Isaac is likely a teenager here. Since he was able to carry the wood for the sacrifice and could question Abraham about the offering. The word that's used for him doesn't indicate, you know, necessarily that he was a little boy, but probably likely a teenager. The significance of this text also launches itself forward in the place that God chooses this. The Bible references Mount Moriah only one other time. It occurs in 2 Chronicles 3 and verse 1. And there it is identified with the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. So this place, God wasn't thinking just about Abraham here. He's also thinking hundreds of years later for the people of Israel, the significance of this location. The fact that Isaac was to be offered as a burnt offering, that would have just been a stunning thing for anybody to read. It's stunning in our minds. Like, it's hard for us to reconcile, if we're honest, it's hard for us to reconcile the character of God with him telling someone to slay in a very brutal way your one and only son. And by one and only, we're talking about the heir, the promised one. So that's a significant thing. And it would have been just as jarring, if not more so, for the Hebrews. Not only do we have our own just human sensibilities affected by that, but of course, the original readers of Genesis would be reminded that the law, and you can see the text that we note there in Leviticus, the law specifically said human sacrifice is forbidden. So it would have demanded their attention as much, if not more so, than ours today. So it's not just that we feel kind of off about this, but also God himself said this kind of thing is forbidden. This, by the way, makes this really the ultimate test of Abraham's obedience and faith towards the Lord. Now, Abraham's confident declaration to his servants in verse 5 indicates that his faith was sure in God's declaration of Isaac being the promised son. And we should read this. This is an important thing in the movement of the text. The New Testament is going to pick up on this. We see in verse 4, "Then on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes, saw the place far off, and Abraham said to his young men," that's the servants here, "stay here with the donkey and the lad, the lad and I will go back and worship, and we will come back to you. We'll come back to you." And that declaration is what leads the writer of the Hebrews to note that this was a demonstration of Abraham's belief in the resurrection. In fact, hold your place here in Genesis. It's worth reading this, because the author of Hebrews sees this as extremely significant. So does James, by the way. He highlights this as a supreme example of faith. But in Hebrews 11, in that passage where we see all of these great saints of old and their faith towards God, We read this in verses 17 through 19. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. Okay. Now, this next word is very important. New King James translates it as concluding. So Abraham here is making a logical conclusion. If it's true that Isaac is the one in whom your seed shall be called, and that was a direct promise of God, if that is true, then he concluded, verse 19, that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, which he also received him in a figurative sense. Now, this is where the faith of Abraham really comes to play. It's not just that he was willing to obey God. His conclusion was God would actually fulfill his promise. Isaac would be the guy through whom the promises would be kept. And that meant that Isaac would be the guy who would be raised. Had to be. So that kind of faith is astounding. It's both unreasonable and reasoned faith. It's unreasonable in the sense that we look at that and we go, that's crazy. But yet, he believed what God said, and therefore he acted in a certain way, giving certain conclusions. Yes, sir.
I like that term in that verse. He offered him up, as if it was past tense. God knows when that point of decision comes, and he sees the point of decision with Abraham, and he knows the heart, the Bible says, and he doesn't look on the outward appearance. We could look at that and say, well, he didn't quite get there yet. God knew he made the decision.
Yeah, it was going to happen. We'll see that evidenced, by the way, in the text, too, because the angel of the Lord has to call him out twice. Abraham, Abraham. Yeah, because he was about to do this. He was about to actually do this. Incredible, incredible thing. Further, we should note that Abraham's confident statement in verse 8 that God will provide for himself the lamb also indicates the level of Abraham's faith towards God's promises. Now, we have, of course, just before, as we were just alluding to here, Abraham is ready to slay his son in a burnt offering. You would kill the animal first, or in this case, his son, and then would offer it on an altar. The angel of the Lord appears. And we should note here that the angel is clearly God. It's clearly God, since he says, "Since you have not withheld your only son from me." And this isn't the first time that we've seen the angel of the Lord as a Christophany, a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. So it was God the one who commanded Abraham to sacrifice the son. It's also God, this angel of the Lord, who says, "You've not withheld your only son from me." Again, this is likely a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. Now, we have this statement, and we just need to point to it for a moment in verse 12, because this is one of those that critics of an orthodox view of God point to. Looking in Hebrews in verse 12, I'm going, this isn't the right text. Let me get back to the Old Testament. The angel of the Lord has called out, "Abraham, Abraham," verse 11. Abraham says, "Here I am," verse 12. And he said, "Do not lay your hand on the lad, nor do anything for him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." So critics of an orthodox view of God have said that this is an indication that God actually learned something that he did not already know here. And I don't think that's necessarily the language of this at all. Rather, as the stronger party in the covenant made with Abraham, God's language is performative, which states a conclusion about Abraham's actions. He is speaking here as a great king would to his vassal at the end of a test. So it isn't necessarily that God is learning anything. He's just saying, this has demonstrated something here. Therefore, God is justified to grant the promise to Abraham and his descendants. And furthermore, it's clear that the angel of the Lord knows what Abraham was going to do ahead of time, which is why he has to stop him with such force. Abraham, Abraham. He knew what was, as Todd was saying, he knew what was in his heart.
Is this one of the verses they use for the open theism?
It is a very key verse that they use for open theism. If you don't know what open theism is the view that God does not actually know the future. He only knows the possibilities of the future. He's on a journey with us. He's infinite in all wise in that he knows all possibilities, but not all actualities. This is a text that they use to try to prove that. The problem is, of course, that we need to compare that with other places in the scripture. And when we do that, we recognize that you don't have to interpret it that way. So thank you, Terry. That's a good observation there. Worth chewing on. But this isn't a systematic theology class either, so we're just going to keep moving on, all right? We'll just let that ring around in your ears. If you've got more questions about that, you can certainly talk to me. I will say this. Incidentally, right now, I just this week finished a book for one of my classes on process theology, which would argue the same thing. Process theologians are still around today. They tend to be very, very liberal, but they would argue a similar thing, and they would use texts like this to try to show that God is just on a journey. They think that's comforting. I don't, but. Letter C. Mount Moriah here gains, as we mentioned, great significance. It becomes known as, on the Mount of the Lord it shall be provided. And of course, as we mentioned later, the temple will be established on this place. Also very significant in this text is the angel's oath. Because in that oath, God swears by himself. You see that in verses 15 through 18, verse 16 specifically, by myself I have sworn. This is the only time in the Pentateuch where this happens. It does occur a couple of times outside the Pentateuch in God speaking to some of the prophets. But in the Pentateuch, remember the Pentateuch is the first five books of the Old Testament. This is the only time God does this. And this is significant because God could swear by no one greater than himself. The people of Israel would continue to have confidence in God's promise because of this oath. And you can see a bunch of references that I think probably harken back to this specific oath. Now for a little more probably controversial question, we do have an issue here as to whether Isaac is a type of Christ, a picture of Christ. And good Bible teachers are divided on this question. Some people note that the language of provision, God will provide himself, God will for himself provide a lamb, seems to point to the idea of substitutionary atonement. Substitutionary atonement. We use the word type, we're talking about kind of like a picture of a greater reality. Furthermore, Isaac's honest question of his father, his willingness to submit to his father, and willingness to carry the wood, these may evoke images of Jesus' pleading for his cup to pass, his declaration of not my will but yours, and the carrying of his cross. And there are other potential things that you could see there as well. Others note that we do in fact have Christ in this account since he is the angel of the Lord. So how is it that you can have Isaac being a type of Christ and Christ pre-incarnate sitting right next to him as he says, Abraham, Abraham. Furthermore, none of the New Testament authors point to this passage as a foreshadowing of Christ. In other words, we don't see any New Testament author going to Genesis 21 and saying, this is a picture of Jesus. Instead, what they do is they actually go to Genesis 21 and say, this is a picture of great faith, which is what James does and Hebrews does. So which is it? Is it Isaac a type of Christ or not? Good people are for it. Good people are against it. This is one of those that I like good people. It's really hard. All right, I don't know which one. Yeah.
One interesting thing to note is that the fact that Christ is in this passage and Isaac has such a striking similarity to what Christ is ultimately going to do is that Christ is actually there
and he knows exactly what he's going to do. He knows that what Isaac is unable to fulfill within himself is exactly what he is going to do ultimately for the sins of the entire planet.
Could be. This is one where I will let people decide for their own. If you want to know what I think, though, I'm actually on record, because I preached all the way through Genesis, and I did say, I believe in my sermon, it is hard to see this text and not think about Christ. So I do think there are Christological implications. But I want to be careful that if you have a future pastor or a Bible teacher who says, I don't think Isaac is a type of Christ, don't raise up stones and say, you're denying the Trinity and Jesus and all that. No, there are good reasons why they may not. Yes, sir.
The ram caught in the thicket is certainly a type of Christ, and that would continue to be all through the Old Testament, the sacrificial system. That is a type of Christ.
Well, it's a type of at least substitutionary atonement, yes.
But it points to Christ, so it would, yeah, in one sense you could look at it as typical. But it is a post-assertion of the Abrahamic covenant, for sure. And so, in other words, this is part of the way. This is where it begins.
Yeah. Just some food for thought. Again, I'm trying to give you tools to help you think through as you study Genesis. I'm going to finish one last short section. End of Genesis 22, we meet the family of Nahor. This is Abraham's brother. He's introduced. He's had a bunch of sons. The significance of this report will be seen, number two, after the death of Sarah. Abraham will know that his family still lives and therefore could send his servant back to gain a wife for Isaac. Moses also introduced Rebekah in verse 23. Likely the birth of Rebekah was not mentioned in the original report. The rest of the report only names sons. So in other words, what Abraham heard probably was only, your brother has had a bunch of sons. The grammar of the introduction of Rebekah indicates that it was an addition by Moses. That doesn't mean it's uninspired, because Moses is the one who's writing this. He's just saying, oh, by the way, this was a big deal because Abraham would know that his brother had sons, his family is doing well, so he could send Isaac back there, or send somebody to get a wife for Isaac, and that's really significant for us because that's where Rebekah comes from. That's the idea here. And with that, we need to stop. So, because I'm already over time. We'll come to Sarah's death and burial and the end, Isaac achieving that wife, and ultimately the death of Abraham next time together. Thank you so much. We'll get ready for our morning worship service. You are dismissed.